Today I'm joined by Dr. Katie Gordon. She is a licensed clinical psychologist and author of the Suicidal Thoughts Workbook. She also hosts her own podcast called the Psychodrama Podcast. Katie, welcome to the Nature and Nurture Podcast.
Thank you so much for having me on, Adam. I really appreciate it.
I appreciate you taking the time to do this. So Katie, I recently did an episode with another expert in suicide prevention, Dr. Mark Goulston. I'm wondering if you're familiar with his work.
No, I'm not actually, at least not that easily comes to mind.
Okay. So yeah, this, nothing more to say about that. It's just, I guess you'll give an interesting perspective. It'll be interesting for listeners to compare these two episodes and see what both of you, he's a psychiatrist, you're a psychologist. So see what overlap there is and how you look at things differently.
Okay.
So Katie, I'm wondering what first got you interested in clinical psychology?
Well, my father is a therapist. He's a marriage and family therapist. So I kind of grew up around the idea of a job where you help people through difficult times and with mental health difficulties. And so I think around high school, I really started getting interested in psychology and took AP psychology and things like that. And so that's when I first started thinking about becoming a therapist. I was also really affected by, there were two people in my school that died by suicide, and that impacted me quite a bit as an adolescent. And I wondered how they were feeling and what could have possibly helped them. And so I think I had that interest kind of early on. And then when I went to college, continued to enjoy my major of psychology, but I worked in a lab with Dr. Thomas Joyner and got to involved in the research. And I ended up really, really liking the research and feeling really inspired to try to understand suicidal thoughts and suicidal behavior better. I also studied eating disorders. And I actually shifted my career goal to wanting to become a professor, which I did after graduate school, and then was a professor for 10 years and then went back to full-time therapist. And now I do both research and therapy. So it's always been within clinical psychology, even though the emphases are different.
Mm-hmm. I've noticed that once you kind of enter into this academia bubble, research, talking about research seems normal. But before I entered college, I was still interested in psychology, but I didn't even know what research was. And most of the time, seems like when someone says psychologist, they automatically think therapist, even though there's research psychologists. So I'm wondering how you first came interested in research.
Yeah, that's a great question. Honestly, I knew I wanted to be a psychologist, and I was advised that it's very difficult to get into clinical psychology programs, and that one thing that I could do to try to make my application stand out was to volunteer to do some research in a lab. And that's when I started working with Dr. Joyner. And then I was advised to do my own honors thesis. And so it was really kind of a means to an end of trying to increase the chances of getting into a clinical psychology program with the idea that I would ultimately do therapy. But I continued to really enjoy research as a grad student and saw the need for it. I mean, there's really need for both therapists and researchers. But when it came especially to suicide prevention, I came to understand just how much more there was to learn. I think some of that is because of the nature of how difficult it is to study suicidal thoughts and behavior. And so that really, I liked the idea of being able to do research. And also during most of the time that I've done research, I've also done some practice. So it hasn't been a major component of my job, but even when I was a professor, I volunteered a few hours a week at the counseling center because I do feel that really helps to make sure the research is grounded in ideas that are applicable to people who are suffering, which is really important to me.
Right, especially for something like suicide prevention.
Absolutely.
So did you have any experience working with patients before your clinical training? Like, I've heard a lot of people who enter clinical psychology, they might volunteer at a suicide hotline or something like that.
I did. I worked in a mental health facility for people who were involuntarily hospitalized due to being at risk. Some of them had attempted suicide. Some of them were found in dangerous situations where they couldn't take care of themselves. Some people were admitted because they were having manic episodes or because they were having psychotic symptoms, and they were kind of unable to take care of their basic needs and be safe. And so in that, I worked as a behavioral tech, and it was direct care working with people. My job wasn't as a therapist at all, but to keep people company, make sure that they were getting to the different group meetings and things like that. And that certainly influenced my understanding of more severe mental health issues.
Mm-hmm. I asked the same question to Dr. Goulston. I imagine that working with people who are suffering must be very emotionally draining. So how did you manage that?
It's a good question, because I think that was even part of the reason why I wasn't sure that I could be a full-time therapist at first. That was part of the reason, in addition to wanting to do research and teaching. I take things on, and I feel for people, and I think that's kind of necessary in the field, but it's hard to balance that. When I was younger, it was really important to be able to talk to other grad students in our therapeutic placements, and we had supervisors. And I think that really helped, but I also think that experience helped too. I think when I first started doing therapy or working with people who had mental health difficulties, I didn't have a good understanding of the limits of my influence. So I felt very responsible, and I had to say the right thing and do the right thing. And I still feel that way, but I also understand ultimately people have agency, and they're going to choose, and they're going to know what's best for them. And I also understand that it's complicated, that something that works for one person doesn't work for another person. And so there is a lot of collaboration and working together with people who are struggling. So I think kind of recognizing my limits and connecting with other people who are doing the same kind of work has helped a lot to cope with that. But there are some days that are especially hard, and those are the days I really try to make sure I go for a walk or do something that kind of helps me to get back to baseline.
Mm-hmm. And even while working with patients, there's like a whole range of cases, right? You might have some people that just want to learn better study habits or something, and then you might have people on the brink of suicide. So what is that like? Do you get to choose your own patients, or do they come to you? I don't know what that process is like.
Sure. Well, when I was in graduate school, we had different placements that we could choose from, and we didn't have as much choice about who we would see. And part of the idea was that we should see a wide range of people while we're in training, so that we are qualified to be able to help people in a lot of different areas. Now, where I work in a women's health department, and it's a medical setting, actually. And I'm referred patients who mostly are struggling with depression, anxiety, trauma, or adjustment difficulties, either related to their life or other types of issues like that. If someone's struggling with a substance use problem or something like that, then I would refer them to someone who has expertise within that area. The other thing is that because I'm in an outpatient setting, if someone needs more to be seen more frequently than say once a week, or they need a higher level of care, then that's when I would refer and try to connect them to services where they can get that higher level of care, and they could return to me when they are back to outpatient. So I do have some influence. So I try to be broad about it, because there's a lot of need for people to provide therapy. And I would hate to turn people away if I'm able to help them.
Mm-hmm. So the Nature and Nurture podcast, mm-hmm. the name of this, you obviously recognize the term from psychology, like how much of things have to do with your environment and how much your genes. And I'm looking at this as an outsider, but I'm imagining that there might be like three broad categories of people who might need therapy. One could be like dealing with maybe past traumas. One could be people going through hardships right now. And then maybe a third category that would fall more on the nature side, where it's like people might have some sort of biological disposition towards mental illness. Does that sound right? Or...
I think the basic gist of it is right. I think it is so complicated, like you're saying. I wrote a blog post on my website that if anyone's interested in looking at that at katherinehgordon.com, because there are different ways to look at this. And so I feel that there are all of these different factors, sociocultural factors, biological factors, psychological factors, nature and nurture, all play a role. But it is true to say that there are some people who genetically and biologically are going to have kind of a higher risk for particular mental health problems. Mm-hmm. And there are other people who are lower risk for that, but maybe they had very significant stressors on that nurture side. And then it's the way that makes it so complicated too, is that there are people who, once you have a mental health struggle, it means you're more likely to have environmental struggles often. So if you're depressed and you're avoidant and having difficulty getting to work because depression is so painful, then you could also, then you're dealing with financial struggles. Then maybe you're dealing with isolation. And so I really see them as more of interplaying with one another. And it's hard to neatly parse them out into different categories.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's definitely always an interplay. I guess mm-hmm. what I was trying to get at there is, especially speaking from your experience working with patients, how often does it seem like there's a clear problem, like a patient comes in and points at a problem, versus it's more just like a general distress that might have something to do with their brain chemistry, or just might be something that's much harder to point to?
I think almost always the case is that it's someone who maybe they've had anxiety at some level most of their life. They're more prone to be nervous, and then something big happens, like maybe they have a child, or maybe they have a loss or a divorce or something like that. And that stressor kind of takes from their vulnerability, amplifies it enough such that they're suffering, maybe it's impacting work or their family, and then they feel that they need help. I think that there are other people, perhaps some people who have bipolar disorder, who kind of, they weren't struggling much, and then they have an onset of a manic episode, and now their life looks very different and they're trying to manage. And so it's hard exactly to pick apart that way. I rarely get someone who doesn't have a specific goal, unless someone else recommended therapy to them and they weren't really thinking about it. And I wonder, it's not always been the case, but I do wonder if partially that's because I'm in a medical setting. So what'll happen is a nurse or a doctor or someone else becomes aware that there's a specific issue, and then they refer them to me.
Mm-hmm. Right. But then in the case of someone seeking out therapy themselves, they've already probably overcome all sorts of hurdles just to make that decision.
Right. And I think they've thought about it, or often they have someone in their life that's like, you really need to talk to someone. It kind of gets to that point. And so, yeah, I really, there are some people I've seen who've been in and out of therapy for years, and some people who are brand new to it, but most of them have some specific idea of what they need help with, or how it's impacting them, at least in the setting that I'm in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there still is a little bit of a stigma for therapy, but it seems like we're moving towards a direction where it's seen as something normal, it's seen as something helpful that everyone should do. But then also, it's like a manpower issue. Even if everyone had the financial means to pursue therapy, we wouldn't have enough people to do it. So I'm guessing that most people might, I don't know how to word this, it's something like, I'm guessing most people still need the type of like emotional support you might get in therapy, but most people also probably receive that support through their close relationships rather than through an outside source. So could you comment a bit on the role of how's a therapist different from like a close friend or family member you can confide in?
Absolutely. I think that one of the big things is that as a psychologist, my training is to help identify what are the factors that are exacerbating or worsening the mental health problems, what are maintaining them. And I don't think sometimes people are aware of them, and sometimes their loved ones are aware of them, but other times they're not. And they really need someone who understands a lot about the nature of mental health problems and who can identify, okay, well, let's track this and kind of take a scientific mindset to it and look to see what's causing that. And then once we've identified what is either maintaining or causing the specific problem, then the tools, the specific tools that we can use to work and make them better, I don't think those, unless you can't always get those from loved ones, because often in my experience, patients will say, yeah, people just tell me to stop thinking about it, or they tell me to just exercise or change my diet. They don't learn tools that are more effective. Those are effective for some people, but they're not effective for a lot of people, and that can feel worse. And so the way a therapist is different is that we do have a set of knowledge for specific coping strategies and tools that we can teach to people, and then they can use them in their lives.
Mm-hmm. And obviously a therapist or a psychologist is going to be an expert in this, but are these tools that everyday people can learn and use to improve their own relationships?
That to me is 100% the goal of therapy, is that, so I should say that for some people, I do think it's appropriate that people with long-term problems, they might need a space for someone who's supportive and checking in with them. And I think that that's fine. For
long-term problems, mm-hmm. Do you mean like a diagnosable mental illness, or do you just mean something like, I can't think of an example of a long-term problem for therapy other than mental illness. I'm hoping everything else could be resolved quite.
A medical problem, maybe, you know, someone has a chronic illness, chronic pain, for example. Sometimes part of their treatment plan is to have a therapist who can help them. And in those cases, it's not something that maybe is resolved. Other times there are people with prolonged grief that it's helpful to have someone to check into. I think what's more common is that, at least in my practice, is that I'll work for a period of time, we'll meet the goals, and then they come back if they need to, like if a stressor comes up or something like that. The whole goal, though, is for the tools to be things that they can use. And that's different tools for different people. So I think that there, the psychologist's goal is to really actually, reminds me a lot of when I was a professor and I was a teacher. We have to explain them. And my book, too, it was all about explaining tools in a way that makes sense to people so that they can use them. They don't need to know all of the ways it was developed. They don't need to know the nitty gritty details of the research behind it, but what's helpful to know is, okay, when I'm having anxiety, I can do one of these five things, and that can help me get through that moment.
Mm-hmm. Okay. One more question about private practice, and then I'd like to get to your book. What does progress look like in therapy? Is it usually like a slow and steady thing, or is it like periods of stuck points and then maybe a breakthrough and then maybe another stuck point?
That is really variable. And I think that has been one of the biggest things that my understanding has deepened as I became a full-time therapist that I didn't understand as well, because when you're in graduate school, you're at placements for a year or two and then you switch. So I didn't really see the idea of someone coming back. And so for some people, for example, sometimes I'll see people who have postpartum anxiety or depression. And for some of them, I can see them for two or three sessions. They just need a couple of different strategies. Maybe they need some assertiveness to ask for support. And then they kind of are doing okay. There are other people who I've seen, the more typical is months. And there are times there are ups and downs throughout that, but the idea is a kind of a upward trajectory. And then there are other people who might have complex mental health problems. Maybe they have severe obsessive compulsive disorder, or they're struggling with a personality disorder or something like that, where 6 months, it might take really sticking to it for 6 months, and then you see some improvements, and then at a year, see a huge shift. And so it's really unpredictable in some ways. And even guessing is not very useful. We try to make our best guesses, but we tell our patients, I try to be open about, I'm not sure. It works different ways for different people. And we can maximize the likelihood that you'll have the most benefits as quickly as possible, depending on how much you engage in it and I work, but we don't know for sure because life happens too. And that can throw someone off track, right? If they have some big event they weren't anticipating, they're unemployed all of a sudden or something like that.
Mm-hmm. So in the movies, you often see something like, you know, people just reach sort of a breakthrough moment. Maybe they burst into tears and then they feel better. Does that happen in real life?
I think that it does happen. I don't think it happens every session or probably as often as in the movies, because it probably wouldn't be as interesting to watch people kind of slowly chip away at something. There are moments like that. What's that? A montage? Yeah, exactly.
Therapy visits and send it to music.
Exactly. And so I think that there are moments like that. But the other thing that I think is a little bit, some of those moments, like the kind of sudden insight and things like that, they might not make the big impact in the change. They might feel like someone finally gets something in that moment and they understand themselves in a different way. But there are other times where someone's like, initially, like, they don't think I'm right about something, or they don't think I'm going down the right pathway, but they'll kind of sit and think on it for a few weeks. And then they recognize that maybe it does help a little. So it's not as dramatic, but it can, I think that's actually more common, that if people are a little curious and open, they can find little ways that help rather than huge insights that then radically shift how they feel. Sometimes it happens, but not a lot of the time.
Yeah. What's the balance between helping someone and not wanting to solve their problems and sort of like steal their victory?
To me, it's really important that that therapists teach the process of learning tools so the person can be their own therapist, if that is appropriate. However, some problems are better solved connecting with resources right away. They're not going to be like, I think if someone has financial difficulties and they're unaware of state programs that might be able to help them, for example, get childcare or something, then I would refer them to a social worker who can walk them through that. So then I would give suggestions if they don't know. But then what I'm also trying to do is model the process of problem solving. But I do see part of my role as just being more aware of things that might be helpful to them that they didn't think of before. But what I wouldn't want to do is a prolonged situation where I certainly don't tell people what to do and I don't solve their problems. I can't even solve their problems if I wanted to. I wish that I could. It's much more bouncing ideas off of each other, offering things and trying to work together to find something that's helpful.
Mm-hmm. What does it feel like when you notice a real change in behavior in your patient?
It's when they're feeling better and when they use a tool or they do something where they show themselves self-compassion or they do something they were afraid of before, it's so, so wonderful. Like I feel like doing backflips. Like that's how happy I am for them, because, you know, as a therapist, I'm really rooting for them. I really want them to do well. And I know how hard it is to do things that you're afraid of and to change the way you're thinking. And so it's one of the best parts of my job is being able to see people utilize those tools and feel better.
Uh-huh. So with working with people who reach extreme lows, so I'm talking about people who are suicidal, do you think there's a relationship between the amount of hardship someone's experiencing and the satisfaction you get at helping them, like helping someone who's suicidal get better as opposed to someone experiencing minor problems?
It's interesting. You're asking very good questions, because I think that anyone, regardless of what their issue is, I won't say regardless of what their issue is, but most of the time I'm happy when I can help them. I think that there probably is a different feeling when someone has been struggling for a very long period of time and you're both worried because they've tried other things that maybe haven't helped, and they, you see them come out of that. I do think that that might have a stronger impact than kind of like when I worked at the College Counseling Center, there were some people with severe mental health problems, but there were also some simpler ones, like how do I tell my roommate that I like not to leave the dishes in the sink, or how do I deal with homesickness or things like that. And so it's all meaningful, but when someone is feeling so, so bad and you're with them on a journey to a place where they are not suffering, that definitely has a strong impact.
Yeah. I think the reason I asked, and this will be a good segue into mm-hmm. your book, is because, you know, I also imagine that the patients that are more severe are harder to work with. So I guess there's a question of like, why bother unless it makes you feel much better knowing that you made that impact.
I think that one of the nice things about being doing more therapy is that there's a lot of awareness about what contributes to burnout, and feeling ineffective is definitely one of those things. And so I think that if you're aware that someone is struggling or they have a lot of difficult factors in their life and it's going to be harder, knowing that you might not see progress for a while, it's important on those cases, especially to consult and have self-care, and also maybe have a variety of different people that you're seeing so that it's balanced out. Mm-hmm. I think that what I've learned from my patients and other people is that some of them do feel turned away though at times because of how significant their issues are. And so I don't want them to ever feel that way, but I do want to take extra steps to make sure that I'm not burning out, right? That I'm continuing, even if I'm not getting those like great rewards and they're not getting them where I'm feeling like I'm being effective. How can I look at small things that improve their quality of life? And how can I balance that to make sure that I'm still as engaged in delivering the best care I can?
Right. So effectiveness, especially mm-hmm. for people who are suicidal, I could see it going either way because, you know, on one hand, it takes a lot to get someone to that place. So it's probably pretty hard to get them out of it. But on the other hand, you might think, you know, they're at such a low place that even a little bit of improvement will hopefully take away that urge they have to end their life. So yeah, is it like they just need a little nudge, or is it like they need a much, much stronger pull to get out of that?
One of the complicated things about working in the area of suicide prevention is that it's so different. For some people, it really is, you know, or is that what you're asking in terms of, or?
Well, I guess I'm wondering, and I know it's not an either or, but mm-hmm. I feel like on one hand, you might have people who are suicidal precisely because their life is so bad and they have nowhere else to turn to. And on the other hand, they might be suicidal, well, for the same reason, but then, so I guess what I'm wondering is, for some people, maybe a little bit of help is all they need, and it's just they didn't have that, and that was the problem. And then for some people, maybe it's like they'll still need a lot of help, and whatever their issues are, it's kind of more resistant to help.
I think that's true, and it does kind of fall all across the spectrum in terms of depending on what all the factors are, because some people, they'll even say from the outside, they feel like they have a lot of great things going on in their life. And yet, whether it's from genetic predisposition or early childhood trauma or whatever different things led to that, they have a hard time feeling good even when their lives are like that. Whereas for other people, maybe they're really isolated and lonely, and you connect them to one or two friends and a couple of meaningful activities and they feel much better. So yeah, it's all across the range.
Uh-huh. So is your suicidal thoughts workbook, is that just for people who are suicidal, or can we all get something out of it?
Well, the suicidal thoughts workbook, the way that I designed it was to be specific for suicidal thoughts, because there aren't really any workbooks like that out there, or there are not a lot anyway. Mm-hmm. But so there are some specific things like safety, right? How do you make sure that you stay safe? But for people who are suicidal, I wanted it to be beyond that. It's not just about preventing someone from harming themselves. It's about them having a better life and less pain. So the book has a lot of factors that one doesn't have to be suicidal, I don't think, to benefit from. There are things that are good for your mental health and good for building a high quality life, regardless of whether there are suicidal thoughts involved, because the idea is to, people usually want to die by suicide because they're in extreme pain and want to escape their lives. And so a lot of the book focuses on that, but then it focuses a lot on making a life that they want to live. And so I would hope that would be helpful to people beyond those struggling with suicidal thoughts.
Mm-hmm. What about suicidal ideation? Like these just little flashes of like, I don't know, someone cuts you off in traffic and then you get mad and you're like, imagine just crashing your car. And then a second later, you're like, you know, of course I'm not going to do that.
Yeah, I think, and I address this in the book because it is pretty common, as you're suggesting, that people will have these thoughts pop into their mind. It's, there's some research looking at people who are not suicidal and don't desire death will have a thought, for example, of jumping off a bridge or a ledge when they're near it. And if it really is something that just pops into the person's head and there's nothing connected to it, then I don't consider that the same, needing the same approach. I think that some people are really bothered by those thoughts, even if they don't feel like they're suicidal. So sometimes people with obsessive compulsive disorder have a lot of those thoughts and they really distress them and bother them. And that would be a different approach too, because it would be more focused on obsessive compulsive disorder. People with OCD are at higher risk for suicide. So it's a little bit, it can be overlapping, but what I would do as a clinician is really try to understand what's going on and what's the nature of the thoughts and is it connected to a desire to want to die.
Right. And then for people that it's completely non-clinical, it's just like these random thoughts, do we have any idea why they come up?
There are different speculations about it. One thought is that in this paper that was looking at how common it was for people to have images of jumping off a bridge, for example, one thought was that it's kind of nature's way of evolutionarily warning us from harm. In other words, the dangerous thing flashes in our mind so we know to step back and not fall over. And so that's been one thought. When you're talking about driving your car and you're really frustrated or something like that, or you're, if someone's doing that, I should say, then I think there are other things too, where I think if someone's so frustrated and they're not sure how to deal with their emotions, they might think of something at that extreme level. So I think there are different pathways that can lead to that. Our mind does a lot of strange things and puts thoughts in, you know, some of those thoughts that pop into our mind. A lot of people have unusual thoughts pop into their mind. And so to me, that's one type of thought that can happen.
Right. And I'm not sure if I misused the term suicidal ideation, or maybe that's just a very minor form of it. But it does seem like there's, you know, like people making a suicide attempt, that would be like the most extreme. You could have someone who's has a lot of suicidal thoughts. Maybe they even thought up a plan, but they've never acted on it. So what's... Yeah, there seems to be like a huge barrier between having these thoughts and then actually going through with them. And very few people go through with them, even if they're in severe distress. Could you comment on that?
Sure. So one way that I think about it is what you're describing sound like fleeting thoughts. It pops into your mind and then it pops out, right? That's mm-hmm. kind of one way of thinking about it. In terms of who is likely to go on to attempt, the theory that I use in to actually guide my workbook is called the three-step theory. It's by David Klonsky. It was developed by him and Alexis May and some other colleagues. And what they talk about is that people have suicidal thoughts. And I should say it also builds on the interpersonal theory of suicide by Thomas Joyner and his colleagues. So I'm sorry, what's that?
What's the interpersonal theory of suicide?
So that theory of suicide says that people desire suicide from two basic things. One is feeling isolated and disconnected. So a lack of belongingness. There's a lot of research connecting that to suicide. The other factor for desiring suicide is feeling like a burden on others, perceiving yourself that your family and the world would be better without you. And so his theory is that people who feel like they don't belong and feel like a burden desire suicide, but the people who attempt or die by suicide are people who are capable of it. And so all of us have a survival instinct. Well, most of us have a survival instinct to fear death and fear pain. And so people who die by suicide overcome that. And so his idea is that the people who desire suicide and who are capable, and this is consistent with the three-step theory, are the ones who attempt or die by suicide.
Mm-hmm. So I've heard about sex differences in, mm-hmm. in suicidal behaviors. I've read that people, that men tend to make less suicide attempts, but then choose more violent methods. And then women might choose to swallow pills or something. So the attempts are less successful, but more frequent.
Yeah, that's right. Women tend to attempt suicide more and men tend to die by suicide more. And you're right, it does seem to be connected with methods. When people attempt suicide with a gun, they're much more likely to die versus an overdose where they could be found or survive. And that has, some of my research and others that I've worked with has looked and wondered if that's part of that capability aspect of it. Where there, we did find some research suggesting that men tend to be a bit higher on things like stoicism, which could reduce that relationship with pain, and sensation seeking, which might lead people to do, I don't know, more things that would basically lead them to habituate, so such that if they desired suicide, they'd be more likely to attempt it. So if they were in contact sports, emergency physicians, veterinarians, those kinds of things might make them less sensitive to pain and less fearful about death. And so it's very dangerous when people who are high on that capability level also desire suicide.
Mm-hmm. Have you worked with any patients who have attempted suicide but survived?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And what usually happens after that? Because I've heard some stories, people maybe made that attempt and then they realized how valuable life was and it like changed their life completely. But then on the other hand, statistically, anyone who tries to attempt suicide once is more likely to try it again compared to like anyone who's never tried.
Yeah, I think that there are some people who were like, I would never do that again. I'm so grateful I survived and it scared me and it hurt my family and I don't want that to happen again. For other people, they attempt multiple times and they think that they may do it again because the underlying factors, the three-step theory really highlights this, the pain and the hopelessness haven't resolved for some people, even after a suicide attempt or it returns. And so I think a lot of it has to do with the circumstances and factors following the suicide attempt that impact whether someone will attempt again or how they respond to it.
Mm-hmm. So now and then suicide comes up in a very mainstream way. Like a few years ago, there was that show 13 Reasons Why. And it, you know, it seemed like it was bringing awareness to this topic and hopefully it would have been helpful, but suicide rates actually went up after that. And so even something like this, a podcast where we're talking about suicide, you would hope that it would be helpful, but what is it about bringing it to people's attention that can sometimes make suicide rates rise as opposed to go down?
A lot of it has to do with the way that it's presented. There were some specific things in 13 Reasons Why that I think, well, it's interesting because I've heard some people say that it helped them talk more about their mental health because there was this show that people had watched, but there are other people like me who didn't like that therapist in particular was overloaded and not helpful to the person. And there were some other factors like that. So there's been research looking at how things are communicated about suicide and the effect that has. So if there is an element of hope involved, which there are a lot of tools. I mean, that's why I wrote this book. There are a lot of tools out there that can help people who are struggling with suicidal thoughts. And there are reasons to be hopeful. That's a key part of the message that makes a difference. Another aspect of it is how it's framed in terms of, you know, honestly, there's controversy about how specific people should be about methods, like discussing methods, because that was another thing in 13 Reasons Why, right? They had a pretty violent graphic scene where she died by suicide. So I think there's a lot of debate about that. But the one thing that I think at least most people agree with is that if you talk about suicide and open up the conversation, that can be really helpful, but it's got to be paired with, there are reasons to be hopeful, there is help available, and there are resources. So those aspects are important. And fortunately, there are some really good resources like the crisis text line and the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline 1-800-273-TALK that are out there and can help people.
Mm-hmm. So how has your experience working with patients influenced your regular relationships? Like, do you think it's made you a better friend, a better communicator?
I think that part of the reason I was drawn to being a therapist is because I do care a lot about people, and I try to be a good listener, and I try to be humble and not assume that I know what's best for people. I'm more practiced at that since I do therapy. So I think that when people in my personal life come to me, I'm slow to give any advice unless I'm explicitly asked for it. And I do think part of that is through therapy, both because people tend to not respond well to just being given advice unless they feel understood first. But then the other reason for it is that in therapy, a huge thing before I would ever give anyone advice is listening and understanding where they're coming from and trying to get that. So I think that that actually has generalized to my personal life, not all the time, but the idea that I'm going to listen to them and I am going to offer support or suggestions, but I'm going to really wait until I'm sure that that's what they're wanting from me in most cases. That's not always true, of course, but I think that having a practice doing that in my work has helped me to do that better with my personal relationships.
Uh-huh. Is there ever a problem setting boundaries? Like, your friends know you're a therapist, they come to you for help, and they, you know, maybe come to you more than they should.
The interesting thing is that a lot of my friends are also therapists because that's where I've met most of my friends. However, friends from before then, like in high school and college, where they're not all therapists, I think when I was younger and less experienced, it was harder to set those boundaries because I felt really guilty unless I was available all the time for people. I now am acutely aware that I have to be a good therapist, really keep good boundaries. And so if I'm feeling worn out or I'm not available, I can express that to someone and offer some suggestions for other people who might be more available at that time. Or I can say, you know, I'd love to talk, but it's been a rough week. Maybe I can talk next week instead. And so I think I've gotten better about that by necessity so that I can be there for my patients and my family.
Mm-hmm, that's great. So maybe we can talk about your podcast now. Is your co-host also a therapist, or do they do research or something else?
He's a licensed clinical psychologist, and he's a professor. And he has done a lot of therapy in the past, but the type of private practice he currently does is very specific to forensic risk assessment, mostly of sexual offenders. So he doesn't do a lot of therapy. He does more evaluations in the context of legal settings.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. What do you guys usually talk about?
We like to talk about societal controversies that have some connection to psychology. So we actually started, we both really like stand-up comedy. So we started talking about controversies within comedy, Dave Chappelle, Louis C.K., and then looking at research on that's related to the things that the controversies were surrounding them. But since then, we've moved to other societal controversies, things that are related to really a lot of different stuff. It could be political, it can be mental health. It just has to be kind of interesting to us. That's our main thing, and hopefully interesting to other people. And the goal is to pick topics that are of interest to people and then add a psychological lens so that it's accessible and hopefully interesting.
Mm-hmm. Comedians in their own way have a unique psychological lens, because it seems like they're very good at pointing at issues that a lot of us deal with, but no one talks about.
Yeah, I agree. Leo and I, that's one of the things we admire about comedians, because they're so good at precisely also feeding off the audience and pushing it a little bit too far. And then when they do that, kind of coming back and bringing it back around. But you're right, they're keen observers of things. And then they express it in a way that will point out absurdity in something that may not be obviously absurd.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything like that, just finding what the edge is and then pushing a little bit further when you're working with your patients? Is it because, you know, on one hand, you want to respect their boundaries, but you also want to help them grow. So does that ever happen?
Yeah, I like to think so, because I think early on, probably being a therapist, I was very worried about saying the wrong thing or doing the wrong thing, but I could worry about that either way by not pushing someone such that we don't get anywhere meaningful, right? Therapy is uncomfortable, or it's talking about painful emotions. Otherwise, we're not really making any progress. And so I think there is a balance. So what I learned is that I can't predict ahead of time how someone's going to react to something. I can kind of guess, but I'm not sure. So if I say something and it didn't go over well or felt uncomfortable, I'll just say, how are you feeling right now? And we'll process that together. And then I'll apologize if appropriate, or we'll talk about the benefits of coping with something, even if it feels out of the comfort zone.
Mm-hmm. And that open-ended how seems important, as opposed to asking, yeah, like, are you feeling okay? And then they can just say yes, and then, you know, go quiet.
Absolutely. And this is something that I remind myself and stop myself during the session now to remember to check in, because there is a certain part of me, probably like a lot of people or therapists, who just are like, okay, I see the problem, I want to solve it, let's kind of do this. But it's not helpful if the person is not connected with you and engaged. And so I try to stop more and say, how are you feeling right now? And then regardless of what they say, I'm going to listen non-judgmentally and we're going to talk about it.
Mm-hmm. Are your patients generally honest with you, or can it take some prodding to get them to say what they're really thinking or feeling?
Some people come to it and they're right away telling me a ton of stuff. Other people, I'll hear something surprising from them, and I've seen them 5 or 6 sessions, and they had, either they're new to therapy and so they're not really sure what to say, or they're really worried about what I'm going to think about them, or they've had past experiences where they've opened up to people and they've been hurt. And so I try to take my time, and I've been very surprised sometimes. And other times you'll bring in someone, another family member or partner, and they'll tell you something you didn't know about your patient either. And so I try to remember that too, that I'm only getting this slice of like 50 minutes or an hour a week, and I don't know the full context of who they are.
Mm-hmm. It seems like some people also, they don't want to be labeled, but I guess that might just be a misconception. So this would be a good place to tackle any other potential misconceptions you want to dispel about therapy.
I think diagnoses are, they have limitations and they're far from perfect, but I'm generally in favor of them. I wrote a blog post in defense of diagnosis, because I think that in my experience in therapy, a lot of people, if they feel heard and assessed accurately, and they're told, I think this is the issue that you're dealing with, and they hear that, they feel understood and hopeful that you actually really get them, and that therefore you can help them. And then we did a study on this with some of my friends in grad school looking at this, and we found that when you do a careful diagnostic assessment and give people feedback, they do tend to feel more validated, optimistic, and hopeful. Not the case for everyone, but so I think being open is a key part of it, though. As a therapist, I try to be an open book about that. Other kind of misconceptions about therapy, I just think there are a lot of exaggerations, which makes sense. If you were talking to me about accounting or chemistry, I would have a caricature idea of what is going on. I wouldn't have an idea of how complex therapy is. So I think that certain therapies get boiled down to like, just think differently or just act differently. And it's not like that at all. Really, if it were, then people probably wouldn't need therapy and it would be a lot easier to feel better. The truth is that it takes time and often discomfort, but that there are ways to look at things so that they cause less distress often in our lives. And part of it is patience, and part of it is practicing what you learn in therapy outside of the session, right? You can get more gains from anything the more you practice it.
Mm-hmm. How about the idea of unconditional positive regard? Are you an advocate of that?
I think so. I can't think of, I am always trying to use conditional responses, no pun intended, but I think that, or qualify my responses anyway. I can't think of a time when it would be useful to not have unconditional positive regard. I think that regardless of what the problem is, having positive regard from your therapist is important. That doesn't mean that I never express if I have a concern or if I felt, you know, criticized in some way or something. There can be those discussions, but generally I think it's important to feel like I'm on my patient's side. Otherwise I wouldn't want to work with someone who didn't have some positive regard for me.
Yeah, I think that's a good thing we can clarify, because mm-hmm. certainly positive regard is necessary, but then unconditional, it sort of seems to imply like no matter what you do, even if it's bad, I'm still gonna have regard for you. And I think that's good in the sense it's like a therapist won't give up on you, but then you also sort of need to have some judgment in this if a patient's going to have any chance of improving, right?
Yeah, absolutely. It's not, yeah. So unconditional positive regard isn't 100% support of every feeling, choice, and decision at all. I just think of it as the patient's going to make their own decisions. I'm still going to generally like them and be rooting for them, even if they're doing something that I might not recommend if I were them, right? It's staying in a difficult relationship. That means I have to really think to myself, it's not so easy to get out of hard relationships. It's not so easy to change jobs. There are reasons that people do the things that they do. And it doesn't mean that I don't like them just because I'm concerned about the decision that they're making. And the other thing is that I tend to really see strengths in people, and that's probably what drew me to therapy. So it is genuine too. It doesn't take a lot of extra work. When you get to know someone in that way, you notice positive things about them, and everyone has those positive things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's a great positive note to end on.
Okay.
All right. Thank you so much for your time, Katie.
You're welcome. If you don't mind, I am going to show my book, The Suicidal Thoughts Workbook, which is available for order now. It just came out on July 1st. And so if anyone's interested in learning more about the things that we talked about today or therapeutic skills, you can look at katherinehgordon.com or follow me on Twitter at Dr. Katherine Gordon or check out my book.
Of course. Congratulations on getting that out. And I'll link your website and your podcast and your Twitter all in the description below.
Wonderful. Thank you so much.
Thank you.